From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Have you noticed more people have tattoos these days? They're no longer just the province of bikers, sailors, or residents of San Quentin. Tattoos, in fact, are in. So what accounts for their growing popularity? What's a parent to do when a teenager says, "Hey, Mom, I'm going to go get a tattoo on my neck. Be home by 11. Ahead on Forum, we'll hear from a tattoo artist, a dermatologist, and someone who studies the sociology of tattoos. And, of course, all you public radio listeners who sport them. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In a moment, we're going to get to our focus for the hour, which is on the growth and popularity and sociology of tattoos. But before we do that, we want to get an update first from KQED Public Radio's Sarah Varney, who has been following for several years now the question of gay marriage and was in the courtroom yesterday when the state Supreme Court held a hearing about the validity of Proposition 8. Sarah, we always want to ask the great tea leaf question in these circumstances because obviously the justices aren't going to make their ruling for some time, but everyone's sort of reading what's going on. What does it mean when Chief Justice George says this or Justice Kennard says that? What
did you pick up on yesterday?
Right, right.
Well, it seemed to me that in this particular oral argument that the justices were really sort of searching for a legal analysis to make their decision on. They didn't really seem satisfied with anything that was put before them. So we had the attorney general putting forth this argument that there are just these natural rights that men and women enjoy and that they're inalienable and that they cannot be taken away. It wasn't so much grounded in the Constitution itself. Then you had same-sex supporters who were saying that, look, even though the court in its previous ruling established that sexual orientation is what we call a suspect class, which makes it akin to race and gender, if the electorate can go out and pick out rights, kind of carve out exclusions from the equal protection guarantees in our state constitution, then really what right is that at all? And there really, although it seemed ultimately by the end that the court was likely to uphold Prop 8, they didn't really seem particularly comfortable with where to sort of hang their hat on that. And they also seemed pretty uncomfortable with the ramifications of upholding Prop 8 and with Pepperdine Law School Dean, Ken Starr's argument, which was that really the people have unfettered ability to take and grant rights at the ballot box as they see fit. And the Chief Justice George went on to say, would that mean you could take away adoption rights from gay men and women or domestic partnership? And Starr's response was yes.
So the key question yesterday was really entirely different from when you've covered this
Absolutely.
Before, which
yeah.
is whether or not gay people have a right to get married. The question really yesterday was whether or not voters can make their decisions. And in California, of course, we have a fairly easy way that the Constitution can be amended. What did you pick up on when Justice George, for example, or Justice Kennard were quizzing people? Did it seem like even though they may be uncomfortable with this, they sort of felt like, look, this is where we live. This is how California works.
That's exactly right. I mean, Justice Kennard, who I think in the previous oral arguments when the question of gay marriage was before her, seemed to be embracing that concept that you would want to expand equal protection to gay men and women for marriage. In this particular instance, she simply said the people of California, and she said, have very, very broad powers. And in a sense, our hands are tied. Chief Justice Ron George, he many times throughout the hearing yesterday brought up this point that the California Constitution is very simple, is very easy to amend, that there are not really hurdles in place to do so as there are in many other states. And he said perhaps, I mean, this is his term, he said perhaps there must be a political solution to this, meaning that the legislature would have to, you know, then of course the voters would have to agree to change the initiative process as it is.
And is this why the opponents of Proposition 8 in part make the argument yesterday that this was more than just a simple amendment of the Constitution, that it was bigger than that, that
right.
it represented what they called a revision
exactly.
of the Constitution.
So that's this distinction. And the state Constitution makes this very distinction. It says if you're going to amend the state Constitution, you can do it by a simple majority vote. If you want to revise it, meaning you want to change the underlying principles of the state Constitution, then you have to get both houses of the legislature to agree by two-thirds majority, and then the voters have to approve it. Now, up until this point, the only time that the court has actually ruled that an initiative is a revision are instances when those initiatives change the attempted to change the underlying structure of the government. So the three branches of government, for instance, and in those cases, the court has rejected that. Now, what was interesting yesterday, and why I sort of started off saying it seemed like the justices were sort of searching for a legal analysis to hang their hat on, was Justice Carol Corrigan, who's the newest member of the court. She is one who was very skeptical of the argument before in the previous time that said gays have a right to marry under the California Constitution. In this particular oral argument, she was simply saying, even though we don't have a precedent to do this, could we say that a initiative constitutes a revision if it essentially attacks the fundamental principles, the fundamental rights of a suspect class? She said that 4, 5, 6 times during the argument, and she seemed to be wanting to help the opponents of Prop 8 kind of more clearly articulate that position.
But it sounds like the standard for saying this is a revision that revises the very core and essence of the California state constitution. The bar for that is pretty high. And it sounds like from the questioning that happened yesterday, that bar may not have been met by opponents of Proposition 8.
Well, I think the justices all agreed that the current bar that's been set, whether or not this initiative changes the structure of government, clearly, Prop 8 does not do that, and there was no question about that. The question was whether or not the court should, in a sense, set a new rule that said there is a different way that we can analyze whether or not an initiative constitutes a revision.
Last quick question, Sarah. The one thing, though, that perhaps people who are supportive of gay marriage could take some solace from yesterday is it sounds like the people who did get married in between the time the Supreme Court said it was okay to do and the time that voters said, no, it's not, that those 20-some thousand marriages will stand?
That did seem to be the leaning of the court. And it really hinged on what the court looks at is was it clear, absolutely clear, what the voters were asked to decide? And their point was, look, the only language that refers to time is this one phrase that said these marriages shall marriage shall be valid in the state of California between a man and a woman no matter where or when they were performed. Now, the problem for the supporters of Prop 8 is that language is actually buried in the middle of a rebuttal argument in the ballot material. So it's not, of course, in the statement itself, which was just 14 words. And so pretty much every justice simply said to Ken Starr, who was trying to defend that these was trying to argue that these 18,000 marriages should in fact be overturned or be no longer recognized. Look, if you really wanted to say this, you should have put it
up
front.
In the proposition.
And perhaps, and even Justice George actually said this to Mr. Starr, perhaps that was a political decision on your part.
Sarah Varney, who has continued to cover this story for the past several years, will no doubt continue to do so on Into the Future. Sarah Varney, thanks for being with us. You can hear more from Sarah's analysis of this tonight on This Week in Northern California, which will air on KQED Channel 9 at 7:30 this evening. Sarah, thanks for being with
us. Thank you.
And now for that line we sometimes say in broadcasting, now for something completely different. We're going to change our focus now for the rest of our hour and talk about tattoos. It's hard to find a growth industry when the economy is in tatters, but tattoos, anyone? Tattoos are becoming more and more popular. According to the American Academy of Dermatologists, about 1/4 of the American population now sports a tattoo, and the numbers go up to 36% between those of the ages of 25 to 36. In Fairfield County, Connecticut, for example, one of the wealthiest counties in America, they now have 20 tattoo parlors. Tattoos, in fact, have always had a somewhat surprising cross-cultural appeal. What else would explain the fact that both Joseph Stalin and Albert Einstein both had them? So for the rest of our hour this morning, we're going to take a look, figuratively anyway, at tattoos. What's behind their rise in popularity? What should parental concerns be, if any, about this? Are there health issues? How do employers respond to the tattoo sporting applicant? We do this, of course, as the Body Art Expo gets underway at the Cow Palace, and the American Academy of Dermatology meets at the Moscone Center. So good time to talk about these issues. Joining us to talk about it, Karen Rose. She is a tattoo artist and proprietor of Sacred Rose Tattoo and the SR2 Gallery. She holds a degree in fine arts as well. Karen Rose, good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to have you join us. Joining us as well is Dr. Susan Kilmer. She's a founder of the Laser and Skin Surgery Center of Northern California and associate clinical professor of dermatology at the University of California, Davis. Dr. Kilmer, thank you.
My pleasure.
And Myrna Armstrong joins us as well. She is professor and regional dean in the School of Nursing at Texas Tech Health Sciences Center. She is also an expert on this topic. She served in the U.S. Army Reserves for 29 years and has observed this phenomenon both in the U.S. military and elsewhere in our society for the last many years. Professor Armstrong, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start with you, Professor Armstrong. Take us through what you've witnessed and the way in which this phenomenon has changed. Back to the days when you first observed this as part of the military, what have you observed in the way in which body art has changed over time?
Well, you're right. It has been an interesting ride, is what I always usually describe this as. You were quoting numbers before about tattoo parlors. In 1994, the state of Texas incorporated some, what I would perceive to be some good regulations as far as tattoo studios. And that was the first year that we registered people, registered, not licensed, but registered tattoo artists. We had 137 tattoo studios at that time. We are now over 1,300 in our state, and probably about 85% of those also do body piercing. And so if anybody wants to truly look at the volume, I always challenge them to think of those 1,300, and if they just took a minimum of 5 tattoos a week, and then multiply that number times 50, not even 52, just 50. And then let's multiply that number also by probably, let's even do 40 states, not even 50 states. And that gives you a number of how many new tattoos we have every year.
And that number would be?
Well, I haven't gone through the math, but, you know, just to get the volume of, you know, we're talking in the thousands. And so if anybody doesn't believe that tattooing and body piercing are alive, surely we know that it's a mainstream activity. It used to be when we were looking for subjects, you had to ask around and you looked probably in certain groups. Now you don't have to do that. You can go to a college campus and you'll easily get your 25% very, very well.
Karen Rose, as someone who is in this profession in the East Bay, what have you seen that's different? Who walks through your door today who might not have 10, 15 years ago?
Well, I've only been tattooing for 16 years. And I'd have to say that only during the first 2 or 3 years of my career, due to the fact that I worked in a what we call a street shop on Geary Boulevard in San Francisco, it was very busy. People walked in off the street and would pick something off the wall. Now, it was a very busy shop, and we were very popular, but my business, even though there are many more tattoo parlors now, I think there were maybe 14 then in San Francisco. There are probably 40 now. And I moved to Berkeley, which is even less, and less street traffic in my neighborhood. We're still as popular. And I think that's specifically because we've been tattooing in the Bay Area for a long time. We have a good name, a good reputation, and the clientele have grown up, so to speak. So instead of some 18-year-old coming in, fresh, turning 18, get their first tattoo off the street, we get that occasionally. But mostly my clientele now are people who are coming in for their second and third tattoo because they have graduated, so we say, to getting more fine art tattooing instead of something right off the wall. And I would say the age demographic is anywhere between 25 and 80. I have a client who's 80 years old. I have a couple in their late 70s.
And if I may ask, what kind of tattoo does an 80-year-old get?
Actually, I put a beautiful rose on her wrist. I've done a lot of roses and beautiful flowers on the 80-year-old women. A few of the men in their later 70s are getting tattoos of their car or their children's names, grandchildren's names, things like that, or something more rugged like panthers and tigers and, you know, dragons. So,
Dr. Suzanne Kilmer, who is a dermatologist, associate clinical professor at the University of California, Davis, and works in terms often of tattoo removal. But before we get to that aspect of what you do, What do you make of this as a dermatologist? Is it something that concerns you from a health perspective?
Well, there definitely is health issues because the tattoo inks are often made of chromium, cobalt, cadmium, mercury. So these are not, inert substances. So they are being put in the body, and then they – well, actually, you can find these inks in the lymph nodes, and you can get what we call lymphadenopathy or enlarged lymph nodes just from having a tattoo placed. So, yes, there's health issues, and the other biggest issue is that at the time of placement, if the needles aren't sterilized or new needles, you have the risk of hepatitis C, and one-third of the patients with tattoos are carriers for hepatitis C. And then obviously anything else could be carried as well on a dirty needle. So it's really important that the tattoo placement is with something that isn't, or the ink isn't so dangerous, that the placement is done in a sterile fashion. So having said that, I mean, then there's the whole issue of trying to remove them, which we can get into. But and we definitely have seen reactions. We've also seen allergic reactions to the inks. And then the inks actually changing colors, undergoing reactions while in the skin.
And Karen Rose, in terms of being conscious of those sorts of health concerns, whether it's hepatitis or allergies to inks, what do you make sure you do so that those concerns are lessened? What do you recommend to people who are thinking about this that they be sure to ask if they walk into their neighborhood tattoo?
Well, let me address the issue of sterility and cleanliness. For example, in the state of California, there are very strict laws regarding sterility and cleanliness in tattoo parlors. And I think that it's unfortunately true that what the doctor says is that hepatitis C as well as MRSA staph are very contagious. And what we call, in the industry we call them scratchers, but they're basically people who tattoo out of their homes, their garage, their kitchen, prison tattoos, gang tattoos, things like that. Really give tattooing a bad reputation. When if you go into any reputable parlor, you should see a health license on the door, on the wall. You could be able to inspect their autoclave. We use single-use needles and disposable everything. Go through a box of gloves every day. And we use a Class A disinfectant for every surface in between each client. And all of our artists are certified in the bloodborne pathogen certification. So at least I can speak for myself and many of my colleagues that were extraordinarily conscientious of this, because any one bad tattoo that goes out there will affect the entire industry. And so most of us do stand up to those underground tattoo artists. We try to discourage anyone we've ever talked to or seen, from seeing anyone like that.
Myrna Armstrong at Texas Tech, where you're professor and regional dean at the School of Nursing. What do you think is behind this growth in popularity? What makes it now somewhat more acceptable, somewhat more the norm, as opposed to being something you just associate with perhaps one specific population?
I think part of it is support. Over the years, what we have seen is a growing support of the population in that age group, I would say between 18 and 30, if they don't have a tattoo, they still support it. If they have a tattoo, obviously they do support it. So, as you have those that have it and those that don't, that still support this situation, you end up with more. But I think the other thing is, from a sociological perspective, we begin to see take a look at the world. We have temporary tattoos at every counter at 7-Eleven convenience stores. There are dolls called like tattoodle dolls, and you that little doll, which costs about $10 to $15, has 100 tattoos that you can place all over the body.
There's even now a Barbie with tattoos.
Yes.
Right?
Well, actually, that's I read that yesterday, and I thought to myself, this is old, because they've been talking about that for about 5 years or so. But yes, there are many indications in our societal picture where it's becoming a norm. And when it becomes a norm, you're going to have a generation and future generations who are going to be very comfortable with it. When you have, you have generations, I would say probably 45 to 50 and older overall, that still probably think this is deviant behavior. But when you have another generation who believes it's art, who believes it's self-identity, it's helping them to feel good, look good, feel unique, then you're going to have more of people doing it. And that's what we have seen over the years. And you see it in greeting cards. You see it as jokes. You see it as newspaper articles. You see it on TV with sports. So, yes, it's there. You know, I was thinking, as Karen was talking, you have a tattoo museum in San Francisco. It was started by Lyle Tuttle, who was a very, was and still is, I believe, a famous tattooist. And one time when I was first starting my work, I called him and I just talked with him. And he said, you know, tattoos are external designs for internal feelings.
Hmm.
And I thought about that for a while. But he said, then he went on to say, but we're humans. And that's part of the problem, that sometimes we, why we're motivated for removal and such. But I thought that was very profound as far as the external designs for internal feelings, because that really is very true. And he has a full body suit of tattoos.
And Dr. Kilmer, is that what you hear when people come in, that what seemed like a good idea, that one something that was a reflection of my internal state at age 18 no longer is some years later?
That is probably one of the biggest reasons. We were also employment and a few other things, but they thought that that's who they were at the time, and then times changed. They got older. They matured. I mean, if you think about it, you don't wear the same clothes you wore 10 years ago. You know, they're out of style. They're out of date because our feelings change and the norms change, and those are all good points that were brought up. But the people change. They
yep.
grow up. They mature. And they're ready for either something else. I mean, we have people that come in to get a tattoo removed so that they can get a different tattoo put on. It's not even so much that they don't like the idea of tattoos all the time. It's just that they're ready for something different.
And presumably, it's more difficult to get a tattoo removed than it is to remove the clothes you wore 10 years ago. How difficult is it? What are some of the things that are involved in doing tattoo removal?
Well, the old way to remove it was to actually rub salt or to abrade the area and have the ink come out of the top. And I actually did some of the original clinical trials in the early 90s, where it was the first time that you could actually use a Q-switch laser, which is a very high-powered laser that fractured the ink and allowed your body to remove the ink through your lymphatic system. So there is a way to remove it, but it hurts. It's multiple sessions. And honestly, at the time, it was actually Rox Anderson out of Harvard. We were doing the study there. We thought about the fact that we were actually taking something that used to be permanent. You know, the idea that the tattoos are placed permanently, which there is some sort of value placed on that by people, that they're getting a permanent thing put on, and making them removable, which may actually take away that concern about putting the tattoo on in the first place. And we wondered, would we actually increase the number of people getting a tattoo, because people didn't realize how difficult it was going to actually be to remove it, but they were hearing that you could remove them. But, you know, it's 10 treatments, they hurt, it's expensive, you know.
And we'll come back and talk more about what's involved in removal and some of the other health issues and things people really ought to think about before they get a tattoo, whether it's permanent or not, when we come back. If you have questions about tattoos, if you're a parent and you're concerned about what your son and daughter might be thinking along these lines, we welcome your calls now. We'll open up the phone lines. Here's the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us your tattoo questions at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. Back with more on tattoos in just a moment. This is Dave Iverson, and this is Forum.
Like the scar of age, written all over my face. The war is still raging inside of me. I still feel the chill as I reveal my shame to you. I'll wear it like a tattoo.
little tattoo music as we come back and talk more about tattoos from Sade as we continue our hour on this topic. You can join us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Let's go first to David, who crunched the numbers to Professor Armstrong's question that she posed for us earlier. If we wanted to get some sense of how many tattoos happened each year, this number of tattoo parlors times this number of people who get them each day times this number of weeks. And so, David, what's the answer?
Hey there. So 1,300 tattoo parlors giving 5 tattoos a day for 1 week. In 40 states is 1.2 million tattoos per year.
All right, David, thanks.
That's staggering.
All right, thanks for the call. Thanks for giving us the number we're talking about. And when people come in, Karen Rose, to your studio in Berkeley, we've heard about some of the concerns that people have that what fits me at 18 might not at 28. How often do you wind up telling people, you know, you might want to think about this because 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you might not want that particular design on your neck?
Well, it's a good place to start because the neck tattoos are probably the most popular tattoo right now, which boggles my mind personally because my own personal tastes tend to like to keep the tattoos below the neck. But it's a double-edged sword because technically my job is not to be your mom. Although I'm a mom anyway, and so I can't help myself when a younger client in particular comes in.
And we should point out that you have to be 18 in the state
of California. Yes, in the state of California, it is actually a felony to tattoo anyone under the age of 18.
Even if there's parental permission.
There is no parental consent allowed with tattooing in the state of California. And we ID every person that comes in, whether they are 18 or not, because we like to have a record of that for our insurance. But anyway, the point is, if someone comes in and they say, I want to have this giant flower on the side of my neck, I usually inquire, you know, what they do for a living or, you know, it's not really my business. Ultimately, my business is to put a beautiful tattoo on in a clean, sterile fashion. And that's the ultimate bottom line. So if they insist, I will comply. However, we usually are pretty persuasive at, you know, put it down on the collar line or maybe behind your hairline on the back of the neck. It's, you know, we'll say it's very sexy that way. Or if it's a young man, I'll say, you know, women aren't really attracted to the front of the throat tattoo unless they're really into the rocker look. And if you're a tattoo artist or a rock star, independently wealthy or have an enormous trust fund, feel free to tattoo your face. I don't really care. But ultimately, we are very aware of, you know, social implications.
So looking at you sitting across from me in the studio here, you don't have any tattoos on your face or neck or on your hands. They're
no.
Up above on your arms, but not on your hands.
No.
And that's, again, for basic reasons of first impressions people get?
Well, I actually like the negative space as much as the positive space because I'm a trained painter. I think maybe I look at my own personal canvas that way, and I do have a full body tattoo, but the empty spots are just as important. And I may or may not tattoo my hands or wrists. I'm very attracted to them personally. It's just a matter of timing and personal preference. But I have no judgment on hand or wrist tattoos. I think they're gorgeous.
Myrna Armstrong, is that one of the things that you think prospective would-be tattoo takers, whatever the right phrase would be, should really think about, though, is, you know, you might not want that on your forehead or your neck. You might not want that on your hand because, you know what, that might not create the best impression if you're going to look for a job.
Well, the first study that we did related to career women, and and when we looked at when they responded to us, one of the things that they said was that I am extremely pleased with my tattoo, but there are a few principles that I have always that they suggested to be followed, and I feel that they have some application. One of them is that you select a site in which you have control of whether it's going to be, and maybe a little bit of what Karen said, you select who's going to have control over seeing that tattoo. And this way, you make the decision if everybody's going to see it. We just finished a study last year on the motivation of removal, and this followed up with a study that we had done 10 years before with Dr. Anderson in Harvard, looking at the motivation. And what we saw this time were more women that were in tattoo removal clinics because I think what is happening is more women are choosing visible locations. I mean, you can just go on the beach, and or you can go to a wedding, and you're always going to see a tattoo on some strapless, you know, person who has a strapless dress. So, you know, again, choosing the site, I think, does help as far as having the personal control that you want to have. I always feel that that's important. That's one of the things. And the other thing is I always suggest that people go shopping around and talk, and if it's a younger person, take their parents and look at various tattoo artists. As Karen said, there are certainly an array of people who are tattooing. And so the reputable ones, and I always feel that there's about one in four that are reputable, they are very conscientious, and they're very concerned, and they will walk you through the whole process and talk about the procedure. And that's truly what you want to have also, is somebody that's going to give you information and guide you and give you the proper care, the aftercare instructions that are important after you've had the tattoo.
How do you find out whether someone's reputable or not, whether or not Myrne Armstrong is right in suggesting that only one in four are? How do you know that? Karen Rose?
Well, I try to have the, you know, that caveat emptor, buyer beware thing going on. You need to go to definitely to a tattoo parlor. Don't go to someone's house. That's the bottom line right there. Secondly, I would suggest when you go to the tattoo parlor, ask to see their autoclave testing service.
Autoclave means?
Oh, it's the machine they use in dentist office and hospitals to sterilize equipment that is reused. In the city of San Francisco, I know, when I worked here, we had a law that required you to have two autoclaves, one backup in case the other failed. But in the state of California, you have to keep a spore test of your autoclave on file at any time to show any client who asks. At my parlor, you can walk through and we'll show you our equipment. You can watch us set up our equipment to make sure that we're using single-use things and gloves and things like that. But because we're a custom shop, we walk you through everything from the design to placement to what it means to you, as well as the surgical sterile procedures.
A couple of medical questions coming in, Dr. Kilmer, that go beyond your specialty of dermatology, but let me toss these at you anyway. Sam writes in, my mother insists that a woman who gets a lower back tattoo on the spine cannot get an epidural while giving birth. Is that true? I don't trust my mom on this issue.
I can't imagine that that actually matters. And from a skin point of view, we do surgeries and have to, you know, go through tattoos sometimes. So, you know, but that's an interesting thought. I don't know if they've set up that standard.
Can I jump in there?
Yeah.
I've had two children, two epidurals, and a C-section, and I have a full body tattoo. And they didn't mess it up. And in fact, the second time for my second child, the anesthesiologist recognized me because of the tattoo. And when I was in recovery, all of the doctors and nurses were on our website looking online at what tattoos they wanted to get. So tell your mom that's not the case. Maybe she's just trying to scare you into not getting one.
And go ahead.
I was going to say there have been a couple articles that have talked about the dangers, but for every three articles that have been in the medical journals, we also have about three of them that say, "Come on, let's get on with this. This is not this is an assumption, and this is no scientific concerns."
That was Myrne Armstrong. Sorry, not Dr. Kilmer. Dr. Kilmer, one more medical question, and Karen Rose, feel free, or Myrne Armstrong could jump in on this too. But Jen writes, I'm wondering about heavy metals, not the musical kind, the kind in tattoo inks. I'm glad this issue is being discussed because it's something that's been keeping me from getting something done. Are there ways of getting bright, colorful tattoos with safe inks? Dr. Kilmer first, on the safety of the inks themselves.
Well, actually, like I was mentioning before, these inks are made up of many metals and compounds that we don't really want in our body. In fact, when Rox and I were first looking at doing this treatment, we were worried about it, but it's only recently that it's come up through some clinical trials that not only are those inks carcinogenic, but us lasering them probably increases the potential for carcinogenicity, which means cancer-promoting or, you know, having things go bad, if you will.
So removal can be equally health-endangering?
That we're looking at that, and it's very, you know, early studies. It's basically petri dish level, But Rox Anderson's a smart guy, as Myrna can attest to. It's been a concern of his. He's actually came up with the idea of developing inks that are based on like beta carotenes and other organic materials that are completely safe, putting them inside these spheres or these polymers that then you could hit with a YAG laser and in one or two treatments completely clear the tattoo if you want. But the best part about all this is that they'd be completely safe inks.
And is that something, Karen Rose, that there's more that again, is a question that a person who's coming in for a tattoo really ought to ask about, the inks that you use, what's known about their safety?
We do have a few clients who ask. It's pretty rare. I usually recommend to all clients who are extraordinarily concerned that they just get a tattoo with the black ink because it's just carbon. It's carbon right. Suspended in glycerin or vegetable glycerin. If people actually ask for vegan inks, if you can believe that. So,
In Berkeley.
Exactly. But the fact is that tattooing's been around forever. And the tattooing with colors has been around since, I would say, the teens. And I would be interested, actually, myself, to see a study on the long-term heavy metal buildup in, say, someone who got tattooed in the 20s. Because there's so many people with full-body tattoos that don't have a problem. And, you know, the people that are so curious about that, I wonder if they eat organic food. I mean, let's look at the rest of the toxics in the world.
And either Dr. Armstrong or Dr. Kilmer join in here on which – is that – good advice to, if you have doubts or concerns about safety, to just stick with the color black? Myrna Armstrong?
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
yes and no. But I think also, again, going back to the and am I right, in California, don't the ingredients of pigments have to be listed? And
yes.
That's one of the only states in the nation that does anything. Because we have to go back to the FDA, who we always think is our safeguard, and what we know is that they have never been approved by the FDA. Tattooing itself has only been looked at as a topical solution and as a cosmetic and not as an invasive pigment. And so and they probably won't ever look at that for a while because they're too busy with all the other medications and such they need to deal with. But we've never really had a good analysis, and now there are the technology is there to look at many more of the ingredients, and this is what we are finding, is that some of these pigments do not contain a good collection of materials.
Let's get to our sorry to interject, but we have lots of callers who want to pose their questions about the art of tattooing this morning, and we should get to as many of them as we can in our remaining time. Ethan is next in San Francisco. Ethan, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a 14-year-old son, and I told him if he does well this school year and gets good grades and stays out of trouble, he could have an iPhone or a laptop. And he said, Dad, how about a tattoo?
Well, the first answer, I think, Ethan, would be is that he can't for 4 more years, right?
Well, I heard that from the doctor that was speaking earlier, but I've seen some teens with tattoos, and I actually know of a tattoo parlor where if you come in with your parent, I guess it's illegal. I didn't know that till today. I was listening, but I if you know the right people, you can get a tattoo, I think, at any age, especially if you have your parent come in with you.
Ethan, thanks for the call, but let's be clear about that. Karen Rose, again, on what the legal questions are.
Yes, it is a felony in the state of California. It's considered battery on a minor if you tattoo anyone under 18 years old. And personally, it makes me sick to hear that any reputable parlor would tattoo someone underage with permission. They either don't know, they're ignorant, or they are unconscionable.
So that's one way, I guess, in testing the reputability of a particular tattoo parlor would be to ask that question. If they're willing to do that, that tells you something to be aware of.
Yeah, and then I'd call the police.
Sasha is next. Sasha, go ahead, please.
Hi. Hey, Karen. This is Sasha from Dragonfly Inc. around the corner from where you used to be in San Francisco.
Hi.
It's great to hear you. I was calling to something that kind of hasn't come up. My specialty is actually covering scars with tattoos.
Certainly.
And kind of nobody's ever, we haven't really kind of talked about in all of this and I know, Karen, you probably can speak to it as well, is that there's so many reasons people get tattooed, and it's, you know, we're talking a lot about health stuff, but a lot of people I work with women who've had mastectomies and those kinds of things, and it can really be a transformative experience. And so I just kind of wanted to bring that into the conversation.
Sasha, thanks for the call. Karen Rose first, and then Dr. Kilmer on more of the cosmetic possibilities here. Karen Rose.
Yes, there was a wonderful tattoo artist named Laura Vita who was working with me when I began, and she was a pioneer in the cosmetic tattooing. But for reconstructive surgery, she could put a nipple on. She could color in skin pigments where there were white spots on African-American folks or people who had dark skin and white spots. Also, for scarring, we can cover a scar, and the tattooing process actually breaks down some of the scar tissue to flatten it out. But most, and mastectomies too, I have clients who actually have flown me to their state to tattoo beautiful orchids on their chest because they choose not to have reconstructive surgery, and it is a transformative experience.
Dr. Kilmer, weigh in on that, on what you see as the potential cosmetic value, but also whether or not as a dermatologist you have any concerns about that approach.
Well, there's definitely value, like to adding a nipple and creating, you know, a structure that may not be able to be created in other ways. But there's also the concern that those inks often contain titanium dioxide, which can darken. And so what happens when people come into me for scar revision, if they have tattooed ink there, sometimes it can darken on its own, or they want to treat the scar, but they can't because the treatment might then turn the inks like a gunmetal gray color, which can then be difficult to remove. It's also really common with the cosmetic tattoos like lip liner, where they have reddish tones in them. The iron oxide in those can undergo this oxidation reduction reaction and get darkening. So I think there's definitely value to them, but there's also, there should be some cautionary note that the tattoo pigments themselves can change and undergo these oxidation reduction reactions.
Susan in Oakland joins us next. Susan, go ahead.
Hi. My father got me my first tattoo when I was 18, and I'm 34 now, and I still love it. And I think part of the reason is because I designed it myself. I spent a lot of summers running around the night floor in New Orleans with a really close friend of mine that's no longer alive. And even to this day, whenever somebody asks me about this particular tattoo, which is of Daisy Duck on a motorcycle, I still love telling the story.
Susan, thanks. We're going to have to let you go because your line is breaking up a bit. But thanks for sharing that first tattoo a story with us. We'll move on next to Steve in Nevada. Steve, go ahead.
Hello. I haven't had any tattoos all my life until the last year. My son had in 07, and my wife and I have gone to Lyle Tuttle and Murphy, San Francisco, and San Rafael. And my inspiration has all been about sleeve level. I'm involved in the world. My wife has chosen business sites on her wrists and ankles. But my question is about heavy metals, mercury and lead.
Okay, well, let me hold you there, Steve, just because your line's breaking up, but I think we get the essence of your question. Back again, I think, Dr. Kilmer, to the metals question.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they do have mercury, cadmium, cobalt, chromium. Those are very commonly in tattoo ink, so they are being placed into the body. For the most part, they're staying in the skin there, but some of that, even without any treatment, will be mobilized to lymph nodes. Again, like it was noted earlier, there's lots of people who have had tattoos for years and not had any issues. So I think it's just the fact that, you know, we just have to be aware of it. We're looking at it actively with some research now. So I think that it's too early to tell, people should be aware that that is what they're placing in their body.
Dr. Kilmer, just bottom line, as a physician, is this just not a good idea from a health perspective to get a tattoo?
Well, I think actually Karen brought up probably the biggest issue with putting them on is really risk of infection. So you absolutely want to make sure that they're sterilized, single-use needles. Hepatitis C is a big bad thing to live with. Then the fact that you have these chemicals in your body, we're not really sure what that means because obviously there's been a lot of history of people having tattoos, but that doesn't really make it okay. It just means we haven't looked at it. We need to explore those issues better. And then this fact that we're treating them, which there are lots of people that want them off. I mean, there are definitely people who love them, but then we have all the people whose employers don't like their tattoos, or, you know, patients who have a name on and they want to change it to a new name, so now they're removing tattoos. And then in this process, are we potentially exacerbating or increasing this risk of spreading these chromium, cobalt, cadmium, mercury, these bad things in the body? So there's lots of health issues that we are now onto, and luckily we have Rox Anderson to come up with some new ways to be able to allow people to have body art without potentially having the dangerous side of it.
I'm sure you've thought about this, Karen Rose, but as a mom, I don't know if you have a teenager yet or anyone approaching the age when this would legally be possible. What would you say to your kids?
Well, actually, they're only 7 and 2, and so they're in the temporary tattoo stage right now. Maybe because they've grown up with me being a tattoo artist, they could care less. So, you know, maybe if I were more conservative, they would try to get one. But, you know, I'll tell you what, if they want to get a tattoo when they're 18, my only thing would be that they go to somebody that I know. Because yeah. I know how to, what it's like. Like the doctor said, you have to be very careful about who puts it in. And, but, you know, I also make my kids eat right. And all this talk about chemicals and heavy metals, just think about all the other stuff people do. I mean, really, my kids don't drink soda either. So, you know.
Jack in San Francisco joins us next. Jack, go ahead. Jack, are you with us?
Yeah, hello.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
You'll often hear the wearer claim that their tat is expressive art or artistic expression. But does that really make any sense logically? The wearer doesn't make the art, but rather buys it oftentimes off the rack out of catalogs. Wouldn't a better expression of one's art be to actually paint a picture or make a sculpture? It seems to be more consumption than wearers realize. And I notice, having working with 20-somethings, that a lot of them do it to be edgy with their peer group rather than being a personal choice. And due to their young years, they don't realize the passage of trends, whether it's long hair or shaved heads or et cetera. It just seems like it's less artistic expression and more consumption to keep up with pretty trends.
Jack, thanks for the call and the observation. Let's hear from a couple of our other listeners. Andrew in Minneapolis, Minnesota is up next. Andrew, go ahead.
Hi. My question is, I'm actually working with one of my friends who's an artist. I want to create my own tattoo, but I don't want anybody else using it. I want to patent it somehow. It's just I'm the only one who has that design.
All right. Well, you know, we'll find out if you can do that. Can you copyright a tattoo, Karen Rose?
Well, no, actually. Disney's tried to sue people who've had Mickey Mouse tattoos, and it's failed. But I have to advise you, just don't let anyone photograph it except your artist. And if it's not published in a magazine, then no one's going to copy it. And make sure that your artist or the artist who produces the work has an agreement with you that you can trust, that they won't share that with someone else. We don't duplicate tattoos at our shop either.
Dennis writes in from Puerto Rico. Anybody who gets a tattoo should anticipate the reaction of grandchildren. Interesting way to look at it. Kevin writes from Milpitas, I'm a regular blood donor, and I have not been tattooed since the blood donation questionnaire asked if I'd been tattooed recently. Is there a way to be tattooed that is blood donation safe? Dr. Kilmer?
No. And I think the recently part is misleading, because you could be a carrier for hepatitis. So as long, I guess maybe they are checking at the first time that you've donated blood to make sure you're not a carrier. And then after that, they're asking if you've had a recent tattoo. But by the same token, anytime you have a penetration in the skin with something dirty, you have the potential to.
So yeah, the concern there isn't so much whether or not there's something about a tattoo that makes your blood somehow inappropriate to donate. It's whether or not you might be someone who's carrying hepatitis?
Hepatitis, or there's other diseases as well, but hepatitis is actually very easy to transmit. You don't need very many of the viral particles in order to transmit it. So I think that is our biggest concern, but there are certainly other things that are bloodborne.
Myrna Armstrong, did you want to chime in on something?
I was going to say that I think it's a year before you can give blood.
Okay.
Yes. And the other piece I wanted to say was on henna tattoos, because I think there's sometimes a tendency to say, well, if you can't get a tattoo right now, at least go ahead and put on the temporary ones. And for henna tattoos, and that dye is the same kind of dye that you use for hair coloring. For some, we also have some
articles in medical literature that talks about how those temporary tattoos with henna will turn into being permanent because of the skin structure and a very sensitive skin. So for somebody who's has a lot of sensitivity, they should be aware of that also.
Quick last question from Donna in San Jose. Donna, just real quick, please. Donna, are you with us?
Yes.
Go ahead. Quick question, please.
I just have a comment about tattoo safety once the person leaves the tattoo shop.
Okay. In terms of sort of aftercare, Karen Rose?
We have aftercare sheets available online at sacredrosetattoo.com. You should follow that closely, and you shouldn't have any problems.
Quick last thoughts from each of you on what you ought to be thinking about if you're considering getting a tattoo. Myrna Armstrong, quick last thought.
Take your time, talk to people, and ask a lot of questions, and shop around, and make it a deliberate decision-making situation.
And Suzanne Kilmer.
I'd be careful about where you put the tattoo, because down the road you may want to get a job that will be limited by where the tattoos are. And I would completely echo Karen Rose's comments about you need to make sure you have a reputable place.
And Karen Rose.
Thank you. Well, what the doctor said, make sure, check it out. Look at people's portfolios. Make sure their work is good. Make sure the shop is clean. And then find an artist you actually have compatibility with, and you're going to enjoy the entire experience.
And think of it as an artistic expression in the end.
Certainly. Like the caller said earlier, or the emailer said something about he didn't really think that the art was art if you didn't draw it yourself. Well, what if I bought a Picasso and hung it on my wall? Is it not art because I bought it? Please.
Karen Rose is the proprietor of Sacred Rose Tattoo in Berkeley. Thanks very much for being with us, Karen. Pleasure
Thank you
to have
very
you
much.
On.
It's been great.
Suzanne Kilmer is with us as well. She is a dermatologist at the UC Davis Department of Dermatology and the founder of Laser Skin Surgery Center of Northern California. Dr. Kilmer, thanks. And Myrna Armstrong joined us as well, professor and regional dean at the School of Nursing at the Texas Tech Health Sciences Center. Professor Armstrong, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Tina Lauerberg, with just additional assistance this week from Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer this hour, Danny Bringer. And the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.